Hello. I'm Mitchell Savage, and I'm an alcoholic. And y'all are something else. I had no idea what to expect when I was coming down here today. I've never been here. I'm not from here. I'm from Tulsa. If you don't know what that is, that's a town north of Antlers. And I'd never been down here before. I didn't even know what a Beaver's Bend was. And as I drove down here and I started to see the trees changing and it was raining, and it seemed the longer I drove, the quieter it got. And I need to tell you that months ago when Paul asked me to come here, I didn't know that I was going to need this at this time. But God knew. And I say yes as often as I can, and I'm grateful that I did, because I needed to be here today and be with you. And so thanks for having me and inviting me and putting this thing together, and I can't wait to find out what I'm going to say. I'm an alcoholic that really should not be here. I really should not be anywhere. After what I've been through, I should not be alive, and I mean that most literally, and you're going to find that out very soon. And so I'm really glad to be anywhere at all. But particularly in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, surrounded by people that understand me, who want the best for me. There is nothing left for me to wish for than to be here with you and to be sober and in my right mind with all my clothes on. In 1984, I was living in Norman, Oklahoma, and I was living in this house that I have a picture in my mind right here that I can see just as clearly as I can see you sitting right there. And I hope I never lose this picture. It was a little white house on South Chautauqua in Norman. Maybe you've seen one of these houses like this where the weeds are grown up halfway the height of the house, you know, and the grass on both sides of the driveway almost meet in the middle. And if you would come in that house, you would have smelled me, and you would have smelled waste because there was no running water. And if it was dark outside, it was dark inside because there was no electricity. And if it was cold outside, it was cold inside because there was no natural gas. Everything was cut off, and everyone had left, and I was there. And I can still see myself laying on that long yellow couch in that living room, and all of the furniture and all the curtains and all the carpet are covered in blood and puke and urine. And I'm laying on that yellow couch, hanging my head off the side of the couch backwards and spraying hairspray on the roof of my mouth to let the alcohol trickle down my throat and soak in directly off the blood vessels in my throat, because I couldn't drink alcohol anymore and get drunk at all, because anything I put in my stomach came right back out. My stomach was totally shot, and I could not drink and use that as the way to get alcohol in me. And so the only way that I could get alcohol was to put it on the soft tissues in my lips and in my throat, and I used to drink that hairspray. And it was a guaranteed puke every time, and my only hope was just to hold off puking long enough to get the slightest little buzz. And I would put alcohol in a little eyedropper. I would use vanilla extract and fill the eyedropper up and put vanilla extract in my eyes to get alcohol in the soft tissues in my eyes. And I can remember thinking that I could quit anytime I wanted to. And so I know that I am dealing with something that is way more powerful than me. Way more powerful than me. And so if I'm going to have any recovery from this thing, it's got to be because I find a power outside of myself that is way more powerful than me, that allows me not only to get to bed at night without a drink, but also to know some peace while I do that. And that's what you've given me in Alcoholics Anonymous. Between the time that I came in here on September 15th of 1984, you gave me a program that if I applied it in my life, I would get the results that you got, which was a conscious contact with this power greater than myself that allows me not to lay on that yellow couch anymore and allows me to get to bed every night without a drink, but more than that, to know peace while I do that. I've received so many things back in my life, my family, my health, my home, work, all that stuff has come back to me over the years. But out of all that stuff, the greatest gift I think you've ever given me is this. When I go to bed tonight, I'm going to go right to sleep. And I'm going to sleep all night long. And when I wake up tomorrow, I'm going to be rested. And I'm going to be ready to do another day with God and with you. And I've tried over and over to tell people what it's like to know that God is with me. Because it says in the big book why we tell our stories. You know, it says we share our experience, strength, and hope. But it also says why we do that. It says the reason we tell our stories is to describe to other people what it is we know of a conscious contact with a power greater than ourselves. And I've tried and tried and tried to tell you what it's like, tell you what it feels like to know that God knows my address and is with me now and is as close to me as my breath. And I've never come up with the words to really describe that. But if you're new and you don't know what we're talking about, just believe that I believe it. And if you can believe that I believe it, I guarantee you if you come back and do these things, you will get what we got. I didn't set out to end up in Norman, Oklahoma, laying on a yellow couch drinking hairspray. That's not where I set out to go. I was raised better than that. I grew up in Tulsa, Oklahoma. I'm from the right side of town. We lived in the right house. I had the right parents. They were both there. We had just about the most normal alcoholic life you could have. My father was drinking alcoholically, but there were two parents in the house. I had some brothers and some sisters. And there was nothing like the violence that I know you sometimes see in alcoholic homes. We were just a normal alcoholic home. My father was drinking, and my mother suffered from whatever you call the illness before you go to Al-Anon. She had that. And my father seemed to have this endless train of chaos that he could bring on. And my mother had this endless list of plans to deal with the chaos that my father provided. And so it was this constant battle in our house all the time. My dad came home in the middle of the night one time with the back of our white 1962 Ford station wagon full of stolen television sets. And he had no idea where he had gotten them. He didn't know, you know, if he was the getaway car driver or if he was the fence man or if he'd gone into houses and carried out TV sets. He had no idea. Now, my father was the president of the Bar Association and the head of his own law firm, so this was really strange. But my mother had a plan. And the plan was, she got all four of those kids up in the middle of the night one more time, and we put our coats on top of our pajamas, and we drove that car out onto like 56th Street North in Peoria and dropped down the tailgate of that station wagon. And with our legs, we pushed those TVs out in the middle of the road, closed up the car, went back home, went back to bed, and never mentioned it again. There was a strong message. Those are Al-Anons that are laughing now. There's a strong message that you're not supposed to talk about this stuff, and so we just didn't. My father was constantly bringing home this kind of chaos, and my mother constantly had a plan. And so living in this atmosphere, you can imagine the social skills that I had when I was about 15 years old. Now, we grew up middle-class Catholics in the 60s, but we weren't really Catholic. I have to tell you that right off the start. Because I know there are Catholic people that are very devoted and very religious people, and we just weren't. This was just one more of my mother's plans to sober up my father, was that we were going to become Catholic. And then, see, he'd have to go to confession and confess all this stuff that he was doing, and so he'd stop, right? The only thing my father ever quit was going to confession, and so this plan never really worked. But I can remember sitting in that Catholic church when I'm a little bitty kid. I mean a little bitty kid, like 3 years old, and I should be in Sunday school, but I've already been kicked out of there because I punched a kid out. So I'm sitting in the big cathedral with the parents. And in this Catholic church, a beautiful cathedral in Tulsa, beautiful cathedral called Holy Family downtown, and there's this enormous, I mean four times life-size likeness of Christ on the cross up at the front of this cathedral. And it was not artistic or subtle at all. It was brutal. You could see the agony in the man's body. You could see the terror. It was an arcane, brutal thing. And I can remember that they looked at it when they prayed, and that we would turn to it and we would bow. And I thought that was God. And I can remember thinking, you know, what if it falls? I mean, where are we going to be then? And I looked at that guy hanging on that cross, and I said, I do not want what he has. And so when I'm 3 years old and I have the faculties of a three-year-old, I made an important decision. I parted ways with God that day, and I was not to look back for 20 years. Because with just what I had at 3 years old, I was making important, important decisions that I carried with me into my adulthood. Incredible. and it was not right away when I got sober that I was able to let go of this stuff. My mother was always trying to sober up my father, and it never really worked. So there was this atmosphere of chaos that I grew up in, and I can remember thinking that I was never in the right place at the right time when I was a kid. No matter where I was, I just wasn't comfortable. I thought that everybody had something that I didn't have, or everybody knew something that I didn't know. I felt like I'd been absent on the day they handed out the rules, you know, and everybody knew how to do it, and I didn't know how to do it. Men knew how to be men. Students knew how to be students. Sons, they knew how to be sons. And I didn't know any of this stuff. And I looked at you guys, and you looked like you knew what you were doing. And I never felt the way you looked. And because I didn't feel the way I thought that you looked, I closed up inside myself and walked around that way for the first 15 years of my life until I found a solution that worked for me. And it was at a New Year's Eve party when I was 15 years old. I went over to a friend's house, and the parents were having a party, a big party. It was a big house, and all the kids had migrated down into this like basement that had been converted into a family room, you know. And there's a wet bar down there because they watch football down there, and there's no liquor. But you know, when you're 15 years old, you can't buy alcohol, not easily anyway. So it's just whatever you can come up with, you know, whatever you steal. It's like you do a little sleight of hand, and we have this liquid potluck. And we're down in the basement on that New Year's Eve, and we had stolen from the parents' party upstairs a 3-gallon bottle of Chivas Regal Scotch, like the novelty size that they put in the window of the liquor store. His parents had bought one for the centerpiece of the bar, and it turned up missing. And we're down in the basement, all these 2 dozen teenagers, and we've got 3 gallons of scotch and 1 6-pack of Coke. And I have always been a leader, you know, so I'm very resourceful, you know. So I take a look at that 6-pack of Coke and that 3 gallons of scotch, and I did a little quick math in my head, and I figured out we were going to have to go really easy on that Coke if we were going to make this work. See, right from the very beginning, it never crossed my mind there would be anything left over. Now, I haven't even had a drink yet in my entire life, and already I'm trying to figure out how to get rid of all the scotch and all the mixture. And we nearly died trying to do it. So it's in this family room, so they got these huge tumblers, and I did it right from the very start. We're mixing scotch and Coke in these big, big tumblers, and we're filling them like 2/3 of the way full with scotch, and your ration of the ice cube, and then a little bit of Coke on top. And when somebody put one of those things in front of me, I don't know how I knew this, but somehow I knew that I was moments away from a new freedom and a new happiness, and that I was about to be rocketed into a fourth dimension that I'd only dreamt of until this time. And so I took that thing and I lifted it up to my face and I smelled it, and standing right here, I can still smell exactly what it smelled like when I smelled it. It was without a doubt the foulest, most vile, hideous smell that I had ever registered in my senses before. So I drank it. I took a big mouthful, you know, and I leaned forward and then leaned back and took a deep breath, and you did it, you know. And I had that first warm sensation that I can still feel when I think about it. Well, I felt it going down my throat, and it burned. It burned as it went down my throat, and the first time I'd ever felt like I could feel a thing that was on the inside of my body, and it was burning as it went down. It hit my stomach like a bomb, and almost started to explode, like, you know, and felt like it was rotating. And pretty soon, I could feel it all the way out to the tips of my fingers, and all the way down to the bottom of my toes. And something happened to me that night. I felt like you looked, all of a sudden. Now, this is all I've ever wanted out of life, is just to feel like you looked. You looked like you had it together, and you looked like you knew where you were going, and you understood where you'd been. And I didn't have any of that. And I wanted to feel like you looked. And I later found out you didn't feel like you looked either, but I didn't know it at the time. You know, at the time, I compare the inside of me with the outside of you, and I lose. And for the first time in my life that night, after I finished that drink, I felt the way you look. I was able to talk to people. I could talk to the girls. I could talk to the guys. I could look the men in the eyes and dance. We did the twist like we did last summer. And I danced, and I talked, and I drank. And that started a pattern for me that I was loyal to until it absolutely did not work for me anymore. That was the first night I ever had a drink. And it was the first night I ever got drunk, too. And it was the first time I blacked out. And it was the first time I had to be taken home. And next morning, I couldn't remember. And I woke up with one of those headaches, you know, where you can feel your hair growing and your cells dividing and you just want to die. And I said, for the first time in my life, that very first day, I will never do that again. And did you know that 3 o'clock that afternoon, that was the first time that I said, let's do that again? Because already I could not bring into my mind with sufficient force, as it says in our book, with a memory of the suffering and humiliation of just a few hours ago. And I was raring to go again. So I guess I drank alcoholically from the very start. For me, there was no transition from social drinking into alcoholic drinking. I drank alcoholically right from the very beginning. As a matter of fact, I have never in my life had one drink. I've just never done that, and frankly, I cannot think of one single reason why anybody would have one drink. Where I come, that's called alcohol abuse. I've never had one drink. I'd be embarrassed to have one drink. I started off drinking 3, 4 in these tumblers, and before I'm even old enough to buy the stuff, I'm not even counting the drinks anymore, and I'm drinking out of bottles and drinking cheap liquor and then grain alcohol. And finally, mouthwash, you know, and NyQuil and hairspray and vanilla extract. And so I guess I drank alcoholically from the very start. But that doesn't mean that it didn't get worse, because it did get worse. But the things that got worse for me were not how much I drank or even how drunk I got. The things that for me got worse were what I was willing to give up in order to have that drink. The things that got worse for me was what I was willing to give up in order to feel like you looked or try. See, in the beginning, I was holding it together and I was living at home and I certainly had my family and I was going to school and I was playing basketball and I was doing well and I was living a normal life and I would limit it to certain times and nothing was interfered with. And I might not drink for 2 months and then I would just drink all weekend long sometime. But I could control when I was going to drink. Now, once I took the first drink, I had no control over it whatsoever. It was not over until it was over. But in the beginning, I could choose when I took the first drink. But as my life went on and it became more and more important for me to be able to just feel the way you looked or to try, all these things like my family and playing basketball that were so important to me started to lose a notch of importance, you know, just a notch at a time. And that sense of ease and comfort that I got by taking that drink started gaining in importance until pretty soon everything that really had any chance of making my life worth living was totally eclipsed and totally secondary and was gone. And I was living to drink and drinking to live. I was living in Norman, Oklahoma, and I was going to the University of Oklahoma. Ha-ha. I mean, I wasn't really going, you know. I would enroll, but then never go. I was a professional enroller. And I was living in Norman, and I was working in Oklahoma City, and I had one of those jobs that requires you to drink. I was a waiter, and I would drink on the job and before the job, after the job. I drank really all the time. But we used to close this restaurant down on South Meridian in Oklahoma City. It was an expensive restaurant, and we made really good cash tips and took our money down the street to the photo finish lounge in the Hilton Inn on South Meridian. Raise your hands. Liars, get those hands up. I see a couple of them. It says we sought out lower environments, and this was one of mine. We went there every single night for years and closed that place down every single night. And one night, about 2 o'clock in the morning, my friends started to go through what by this time was just the nightly agenda, and that was to find Mitch, because I turned up missing a lot. And they found me this night outside, laying in a ditch outside of the bar. And I'd been in a fight with two guys, and I had not won. And I was laying in this ditch, and I had a cut that went from about the middle of my forehead down over this eyebrow and across the top of this eye down to about right here. And I was bleeding, and there was blood in my eye was swollen shut, and I had a fat lip. And they picked me up, and I'm covered in mud and dead grass clippings because it was about the fall of the year. It'd be like getting out there right now and just rolling around in it. And they throw me in this car, and they take me back to Norman to Brenda, who was a girl that I lived with at the time. And Brenda had not discovered the miracle of the Al-Anon family groups. And so she was at the assigned post at the designated time. You know, it's 2 o'clock in the morning, and she's standing at that front door. And she's in that Al-Anon pose, you know. And she's standing there just tapping her foot to where her whole body moves like this. You know, and my friends come down the street, and they're scared of her. So they just slow the car down long enough to push me out the door, and I start rolling up that driveway, and I'm crawling up the driveway because I'm tired of falling. And I crawl through that big oil spot, you know the one, because I had one of those cars, because that's the way our cars do. They bleed oil. And so I crawl through that oil slick, and she's standing there at the front door, and I'm covered in mud and dead grass clippings and oil, and I'm just trying, you know, to not be noticed and get in. And she sees me, and she says to me the strangest thing. She looks down at me, and she says, "If you can't control yourself when you start to drink, why do you even drink at all?" Have you ever heard of such bullshit as this? I mean, what? When I think about that today, that seems like a really good question. But back then, she might as well have been speaking Portuguese. I had no idea what she was talking about. So laying there on the floor with this gash that goes from here to here and this eye swollen shut and a fat lip, I said, "I drink because it's fun." But the thing I really want you to know is I meant it. I was totally serious. That was as much as I knew. See, drinking had been fun for me for a time. But there'd come a time when it had changed, and that was all lost to me. And so I know exactly what it means in the doctor's opinion in our book when it says that we can't differentiate the true from the false anymore because our alcoholic life seems the only normal one. Because by that time, I was very adept at surrounding myself with people that drank just the way I did. So I didn't have to seem abnormal. See, I might have thought a lot of this stuff was strange if I would have thought about it at all, but that's what I didn't do. I surrounded myself with these people. If you did not drink the way I drank, you were not around me. We had a word for it back then. We called it cool. Remember that? He's cool. Yeah, that means he's just as big a loser as we are, and he can come in. He's not going to tell anybody what we got in here. So back then was also when I used to wake up in my car all the time, and I thought everybody woke up in their car from time to time. I just thought that was when, you know, you had a good time, you woke up in your car. Today, I know dozens of people who have never woken up in their car, and I didn't even know they existed before. But I woke up in my car this one day, and when you wake up in your car, it's always for the same reason. Right? It's because it's getting hot in there. And I was perfect. I see those nodding heads. I was perfectly comfortable when I went to sleep. And now it's getting hot in there. And all of a sudden you go like that. And you realize you've got that taste in your mouth again. And I don't know where I am. And I look around. And the procedure for waking up in your car is you've got to get out of the car and check for damage, you know, and small animals embedded in the grill. Find the keys to the car. Get in the car. Drive around until you see something you recognize. And go home. No problem. And this is a good day for me when I wake up in my car, really. Because, you know, on other days, I would just have to wake up and go look for my car. And so I figured if I woke up in my car, I was hours ahead. So I wake up in my car this day, and I go through the procedure, and I start driving around, and I do not see anything that I recognize. And I'm starting to get scared. So I pull over to this filling station, and I ask this guy how to get back to I-35. Now, I-35 runs right through the middle of Oklahoma City. Everybody in Oklahoma City knows how to get back to I-35. This guy did not know how to get back to I-35. Wait, you're getting ahead of me. So he goes in this filling station, and they have this enormous map that covers the whole wall of the filling station, and he looks at that thing for like 5 minutes. And he comes back out to me, and he's looking at me now like I'm turning into a werewolf or something. And he says to me, okay, you got to go up here and go left and then go right and then go up here and then get on I-40 and drive for 20 hours. So I'm cool, you know. So I says to this guy, who said that? I said to this guy, where am I? And he said, Phoenix, Arizona. And I have no idea. I have no idea how I got to Phoenix, Arizona, why I went to Phoenix, Arizona, what I did, where I slept, what I ate, if I ate. I have none of those moments, not one single moment, has come back to me. And I think that blackouts are God's way of saying, you really don't want to know. And because I have great faith in God, I know there's a special place in hell reserved for those people to wake up the next day and go, do you want to know what you did last night? I'd go, no. Leave it there. So I get back in my car that day and I drive 20 hours back to I-35, and I don't think that's strange because I don't think about it at all. And when I got back to the house that day, I walk in the kitchen, and there's an answering machine in the kitchen, and the light's just going like this, just blinking like this, you know. And I figured out by this time that I've been gone for 5 days. 5 days. And I have no memory of any of it. And that answering machine light is going like this. And I walk over, and I punch the button, and one of the first messages is from my brother, Matt. And Matt lived in New York City. I was in Norman. And he was calling me from Tulsa, which was strange. And he said, Mitch, Dad's had a stroke and he's in the hospital and you have to come home right now. And I stood there and I listened to that message and I just started to shake. I was terrified because by this time I'd figured out that I'd been gone for 5 days and I didn't know how long that message had been there. And I listened to a couple of more messages and then it's my brother Matt again and he says, Mitch, what's the matter? Didn't you get my message? Listen, Dad's in the hospital and you need to come home. And then a few more messages go by and it's my brother Matt again and he says, look, Mitch, I know what's going on, but you have to pull it together this time. This is really, really important. And I stood there and I'm shaking to where you can see me shake. And I don't know what's going to come next. And I know that as I stood there waiting for the next message, I tottered back and forth to where I was so terrified and so unable to live through the moment that was coming that I know that I could have taken one step that way and never come back. Never come back. And the next message was from my brother Matt. And he said, look, just stay away. Just stay away. And he was a good man for doing it, for protecting my mother and the rest of my family in that way, because no matter what was going on, I could only make it worse. And my father walked out of the hospital at that time. And so I was very lucky or very blessed or something. But I was so embarrassed and so ashamed that I didn't talk to anybody in my family for the next 3 years until after I got sober. And I went on doing what I had to do until I couldn't do it anymore. I tried everything that I could in order to solve this problem, and I remember thinking that the problem must be that I was living in the wrong place. So I moved. And then I got evicted from the place that I moved to that was going to be the solution to my problems. And so I figured out, you know, I needed to change schools, so I did that, and I got kicked out of the University of Oklahoma. Now that is almost impossible to do. I needed a new car, so I got a new car. I knew that was going to fix it. And then that car got repossessed. And all these things that I'm trying to use to solve what's going on with me are not only not solving it, they're falling away, or walking away, or being taken away, or I'm being sent away. And there came a time when all my scorecards read zero, as it says in the book, and I had one of those moments that I think you might only get one of. I don't know. Maybe you get two. I don't know. I'm going to let this one be enough for me. But there's a lady in the story section that describes it best when she says, "The walls crumbled and the light streamed in." And I had a moment like that, sitting there one night. And I can tell you that an hour before, I could not have told you that alcohol was related to my problem. But when I knew, I knew. And I also knew where the solution was. Because I'd moved back to Tulsa, and I was living with my parents because it was the only thing that I could do. And my father was sober now, 13 years in Alcoholics Anonymous. And my mother was this 14-year black belt, Al-Anon, and there was no shucking and jiving going on in that house. So I'm living with this picture of sobriety and serenity, you know, and I'm drinking hairspray around the clock. And so the contrast was pretty big. So that when the time came, I knew where to go for the solution. And I was by myself, and I was sitting there, and there was nobody else home. And I picked up the phone that night, and I dialed that 627-2224. And in Northeast Oklahoma, that's Alcoholics Anonymous. And we have a really good there because that phone is always answered by an alcoholic. There's no answering machines. There's no service. 24 hours a day, all year long. It's answered by an alcoholic. And I'm so glad that I didn't get an answering machine because I don't know if I would have called back or left a message. But that night, it seemed like it rang 100 times until this voice came on the other end and said, "Hello?" And I said, "Is this Alcoholics Anonymous?" And he said, "Yes." I said, "Great." And I said, "Well, I think I might have a drinking problem." And this guy says, "Well, I found a solution that works for me, and it's all about a daily reprieve that's contingent on my maintenance of a spiritual program." I'm thinking, who is this guy? A daily reprieve contingent on my maintenance of a spiritual program. What's that? "How do you not take a drink?" I says. And he says, "Well, I think you need to go to a meeting. There's one tonight." And I said, "Well, I can't go tonight. I've got things to do." Now, when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous in 1984, I was 6 feet tall, just like I am right now. And right now, I weigh 200 pounds. Back then, I weighed 128 pounds. So one-third of me is gone. You can put your middle finger and your thumb around my arm up at the shoulder, and it goes all the way around. My skin is gray. And my eyes are so yellow, they look orange. I can't see because of all that vanilla extract I've been putting in my eyes. It looks like I'm looking through wax paper because I got this goop in my eyes. It's just sort of always there. It never goes away. I am shaking visibly. I don't mean that I am trembling. I mean, you don't even have to be sitting next to me to see that I am moving. You know, I would just be sitting there and all of a sudden I'd go, "What's that?" We used to call it the whips and jangles because you would whip like this and the change in your pocket would jangle, you know? And it was the whips and jangles. I had the whips and jangles. What did I have to do? I didn't know it at the time, but I was already suffering from my very first ego trip inside Alcoholics Anonymous because I didn't want to come to your meeting looking the way that I looked because I thought you wouldn't like me. And I wanted to have a few days to sober up before I came here. little did I know, it only got worse for the first few days. So he says to me, well, when do you think you could squeeze it in? And I said, I think Monday would be about the quickest I could get around to it. This is on a Thursday. So I show up at Alcoholics Anonymous 3 days past my last drink with no program of action going on in my life. I look like Frankenstein in a hurry. I'm like, I just shook and my head would twitch and I couldn't see and I bumped into things. And he told me to go to this meeting and he said, I'll meet you at the door. And I get there and, you know, I walked right past him. I didn't know who he was. And he later told me he knew exactly who I was. But I went right in this meeting and before I even get to a chair, somebody says to me everything I remember from my first meeting. And I want to tell you what it is. This is everything I remember from my first meeting. They said, our coffee's over here and you can sit by me. And that's everything I remember from that meeting. And I'm so glad there was somebody there to do that, because I don't know if I'd have even gotten to a chair. I was terrified. And, you know, I think that's the most important work we do, is at the door of our group, when we look for the people that we don't recognize. And you say, our coffee's over here, and you can sit by me. I think that's the most important work we do. And I've been a chairman of a conference. I'm the chairman for Area 57, the state of Oklahoma. I've sponsored dozens of men, and the most important work I do is at my group on Tuesday and Thursday night. If you're there and I don't know you, I'm going to get your coffee, and you're going to sit by me. And no matter how new you are, I don't think there's anybody that can't do that. And if you can do that, you've done the most important work we do. No matter how new you are, you can still do that. Just let them sit there and say, welcome home. And don't worry that you don't have anything to say to them, because they're not listening anyway. But let them sit by you. Somebody said, keep coming back, and so I did. You know, it wasn't like I had a lot of places to go. And I kept coming back, and somewhere in there it was suggested to me that I should get a sponsor. And so I did. I got that guy that answered the phone that night to be my sponsor. I went up to him and I said, Jane, would you be my sponsor? And he said, yes! And more was revealed to him. Jane sponsored me from A to Z. From A to Z. He told me the simplest things and the headiest things. Jane taught me how to pray, and he taught me how to shave. I didn't know nothing. I was living like an animal. He told me that I could have anything I wanted out of life as long as I was willing to provide it to myself. I remember the first time Gene asked me to go out to his house. He lived outside of town, in fact, outside of a small town outside of Tulsa, near Leonard. And it was really quiet out there where he lived. And there was a lake in the backyard. And I remember the first time that I went to his house, I knocked on the door and he came to the door. And when he opened the door, he asked me to come to the inside of his house. And I looked to see if there was somebody else there, because nobody asked me to come to work to me. That alone would have changed my life. But he did talk to me, of course, and told me things that I've never forgotten and things that are part of me today. Gene told me that there was nobody anywhere who had anything in here or in here that I didn't have. And I did not believe him. But I believed that he believed it. And I kept coming back to hear it, because it was so much nicer than anything else anyone was saying to me. And I kept coming back, and he told me these things, and he was so active. He took me everywhere, and we went to conferences, and we went to speakers, and we went early. I think I was 2 years sober before I ever went to a meeting any less than 45 minutes early. We were always 45 minutes early. We were always setting up the chairs, and we weren't signed up. We just did it. And we always stayed after, and we washed the ashtrays, and we weren't signed up to do that either. We just did it. That's what he did. He was so active. And one of the hardest times in my sobriety was back in the spring of 91, when we had to bury Jane, because somehow, after 13 years of sobriety, Jane, after saving my life, came to the conclusion that his life was no longer worth living. And he closed himself up in that garage and opened the windows to that car, and he started that car, and he sat there, and he waited until it was over. And Gene did this stone cold sober. And I don't have anything good to say about Gene's passing in that way, except that many of us learned to say goodbye, and a lot of us drew closer together. But I can tell you this, Gene taught me in the beginning, and he taught me in the end, that if I will have anything from Alcoholics Anonymous, it'll be a daily reprieve, contingent on my maintenance of a spiritual program today. Today is going to be the day when I have to go to any length to stay sober. No matter what, I've had a drink in 13 years, and I would no more be without a sponsor today than when I was 13 days sober. No way. Today is the day I have to be willing to drive to Beavers Bend State Park after being in Chakota this morning to introduce a speaker there. I have to do that today to stay sober. I can't stay sober today on what I did yesterday. That's gone. This is the day I have to be willing to sponsor all six of those whiners I sponsor. You cannot believe there's a bunch of losers I sponsor. Oh, there's none of them here. I got to do it today. There are no points. There are no balances. What I do since I woke up today is going to determine whether I get to bed tonight without a drink. And in that respect, we're all on the same footing, under the same God. And in that respect, we enjoy perfect unity in AA. And we can share the love that God has for us today. And my friends, I'm here to tell you that that is the only thing that's real. The love that God has for you today will get you to bed without a drink, but more important than that, allow you to go right to sleep. I kept coming back, and I did these things that were suggested to me, and pretty soon my life started to change. And people started to tell me that I looked better, and I didn't really know what they were talking about. And they started to say that they could understand what I was saying all of a sudden, and I didn't know what they meant. But they told me that I was doing better. And it was always for me in hindsight and looking back and listening to other people that I could see my recovery. When I'm on the way through it, it never seems like it's going to end. When I'm in the middle of the worst part of it, it still seems real. And I've been here for 13 years, and I know God is here with me now. But I'm still telling you, there are some times when I'm in the middle of it, it seems real, whatever I'm going through. I guess that's just part of the human condition. And my job in sobriety or my job in a spiritual awakening is not to sidestep the human condition, but to learn to live it with love and with faith in God so that the problems in my life don't go away. The problems don't go away. Life is life. But I have a God that walks with me and carries me and gives me what I need on a daily basis. And I'm as sure of that as I am sure that I am standing here. There were certain things when I got sober that I wanted to put back in my life that I knew were going to take more purposeful action than just prayer. And there is prayer, and we have to pray. I know I still have to pray. But if I want to earn a living, I got to go out and get a job, too. And I wanted to, when I was about a year sober, I decided that I wanted to go back to school. And now, remember, I'm kicked out of the University of Oklahoma, and I'm living in Tulsa now. And the University of Tulsa is a really good private school. And I show up there with this transcript from OU that reads like an arrest warrant. It just rolled out on the floor. I went to OU for 3.5 years and chalked up 12 credit hours. And the rest of it is F's because I would enroll in these classes and never show up. I've enrolled and paid for the same class 4 or 5 times, several of them, and never seen the instructor. And so I've got this transcript, and I want to go back to school. And I go to TU, and I go through this admission process, and this lady is there. And my sponsor's telling me, you just have to do the footwork. The results are up to God, but you have to show up and do this. And I'm scared, and I'm intimidated, and I'm embarrassed. But I show up there, and this lady looks at that transcript, and she says, what is this? And so I took a big risk and told her the truth. I said, well, that was then and this is now. I'm an alcoholic. I'm a recovered alcoholic. And I want you to let me try to go to your school. And I can still see that lady right now with her arms folded like this, and she's looking at me out the side of her face. And she says to me, I don't know anything about what you're talking about, I don't even know if you're telling me the truth, but I'll tell you what I'm going to do, she says. I will let you in this school, and I don't have to do that. She said, I'm going to let you in this school on what we call grade 5 academic probation. I'd never even heard of anything like that before. It must be good. And she goes, this is the deal. You go part-time. You're not a member of any organization or club. You do not get a basketball ticket. You take 2 classes, and that's it. You miss 1 class period, and you're out of here. You get 1 C, and you're out of here. I get any bad feedback from any of your instructors, and you're out of here. And those are the conditions. How's that? And I said, okay. And so I said the prayer, and I went back to school one day at a time, and I went to school part-time, and at the end of that semester, I'd taken those 2 classes and done nothing else, and I got 2 A's. I couldn't believe it. And when I told that lady I'd gotten 2 A's, she said, that's great. You've got just 2 more semesters of academic probation. So I go for a year and a half on this probation, taking 2 classes at a time, thinking I'm going to be 100, trying to calculate, I'm going to be 175 years old by the time I get out of school at this rate. And so after a year and a half, I finally get off probation, and I'd made straight A's the whole time I was on probation. And I did not make straight A's the whole time that I was in school, but I did finish. And that's something. In fact, it might be the first thing I ever finished in my life. In December of 90, I graduated from the University of Tulsa with one of the best degrees that you can get from a business school. But my favorite part of getting off this probation was not just that I could go full time. It was that I could start to do more. I could join some of those organizations, you know, and really give back. And not just show up and get my ticket stamped and get my piece of paper and get out of there, but to give back the way you had taught me to do. And so I started going to these academic things, and I started going to these games, and I started meeting people, and I started having friends. And my sponsor said, that's what we do. We return to the mainstream of life. And he said, you know, you'll be surprised if you will just iron your shirt and show up early and don't hit anybody and don't steal anything. You will be surprised on how far you can go on just those simple values. And so that's what I did. So imagine my surprise when I'm the senior, in my senior year, I'm the president of the academic organization in my major field. I couldn't believe it. And when I was the president of that little club, I recruited the help of some large companies, and we started a trust fund that's still there and is self-perpetuating. And the interest alone off that trust fund awards 2 scholarships to people in my major field. And one of those scholarships is named after me. And I think you can't get where I am from where I started out. You can't get from there to there. Nobody gets from there to there. How could that happen? The only thing that I can tell you is that I came here and I applied these steps. I tried to be of service to other people, and I did the footwork. I ironed my shirt and showed up early, and I didn't hit anybody or steal anything. I was surprised on how far I could go. I had no idea. You know, I'd been sober for a while, and I started making amends, and of course, the hardest amends for me to make were to my family, because even into sobriety for a time, I wasn't talking to them because I was still humiliated and embarrassed and ashamed of the episode from when Dad is laying in the hospital with a stroke and Mitch is in Arizona on a 5-day blackout. And I go to my sponsor and I say to him, how do you heal a relationship with somebody that you can't even be in the same room with? And I thought I really had him. And do you know what he said to me? He said, well, you start by being in the same room with them. Oh, this was like physics to me. I'd never thought of that. It never occurred to me that there was going to be like little steps you would take first. I just always looked at this huge mountain of a problem and thought I could never eat that in one bite, and so I would never even approach it. And he said, the first thing you have to do is go there. And so I did. I had a little over a year of sobriety, and I start going around my father, and we have nothing to say to each other, and I'm scared and I'm nervous, just like when I'm standing in that admissions office at TU. But my sponsor says, you have to do the work, and then God will take care of the results. So I show up there, and in a short time, I found out, much to my relief, that my dad and I did have something in common, one thing that I knew of at that time, and it was baseball. We loved to watch baseball. And we start watching baseball games on TV together. and when the game is over, we turn off the TV, and I get up and I leave. And this is the extent of my relationship with my father. Now, that's pathetic, but it was something. And I was there. And as the weeks go by, we started talking. And we didn't talk about anything but baseball, but we were talking. And after about a month or two, we're sitting there and we're watching a game, and I get distracted and I'm talking to my dad about something, and all of a sudden I realize we're not talking about baseball, we're talking about my family. And I realize we've been talking for quite a while and the game is over and I don't even know who's won. And I'm sitting there talking with my dad. Not because there was a big bolt of light, there was no flash, there was no drama, there was no burning bush. Those two people just showed up. And in a very unspectacular way, God did what God does, and the result was spectacular, although the steps were little. I was so grateful that I was able to make peace with my father. In fact, over the years, he actually became one of my best friends. I thought that once I just got over being scared of him, that was all I could ever hope for. And I was really surprised when he turned out to be somebody that I could go to for advice and take it. And in March 12th of 91, we had to put my dad in the hospital in the middle of the night because he didn't feel well, and he didn't know what was wrong with him, and the doctors didn't know what was wrong with him, and I was there. And I was helping him be comfortable, and I was holding his hand and rubbing his forehead, and it was a hellacious night. It really was awful. And the next morning, I went to go run an errand for my mother and to do something for myself, and I came back to the hospital at about 10 o'clock in the morning, and I'm walking down the hall to go back to Dad's room. And off to the side, my eye is caught by this room in there, and it's not a patient room, and it's not a doctor's office. It's just one of these small little rooms with a table and a few chairs, and my whole family's in there with a social worker, and they're crying. And my mother sees me, and she jumps up, and she puts her arms around me, and she says, "Mitchell, it's over." Just like that. It's over. And I didn't want it to be over. And I'm sure you never do. But I can tell you this. There was nothing left unsaid. Nothing. And they said, "Do you want to see him?" And I said, "Yes." And I started walking down the hall, and they started to go with me, and I said, "I want to go by myself." And as I walked down that hall to see him for the last time, I had one feeling. And that is strange for me. I'm usually over here and over there, and I'm thinking about 10 things. But I'm walking down that hall, and I have one feeling, and it's gratitude. It's gratitude for the fact that he wasn't sick anymore, because he had been sick for a very long time. And it was gratitude for the fact that I was sober, and that when I got down there, I could say goodbye, and that there was no unfinished business. And it was gratitude for the fact that it was not the first time that I said, "I love you." And I was able to let go when it was time to let go, because the business was done with during the lifetime. And in the weeks that followed that, the strangest thing happened. The first thing I found out is that in hours, we were surrounded by you people. You never let us go. You were always there. But I was the one that week that took care of my mother. I was the one that made sure that my mother ate and that the towels are washed at her house and all this stuff that nobody thinks about. That was me, because the rest of my family was incapable. I was the one that did that. And I think about that time, and I think about when I'm back there in Norman, standing in that kitchen, listening to that answering machine, watching that light blink, and standing in this world where I literally could have taken one step the other way and never come back mentally. And I think, how do you get from there to here? This does not seem possible. And my dad died on a Tuesday, and we planned a memorial service for the Friday. And on Wednesday, my mother said to me, my father was a very spiritual person. He was 20 years sober in AA and helped a lot of people, but he was absolutely not religious. And so my mother said, "We're not going to have a minister at this memorial service." And she says to me, "I'd like for you to give your father's eulogy." And I think, how do you get here from there? It doesn't seem right. I shouldn't even be alive I shouldn't even be alive. And I'm not only alive, I am loved, I am sane, and I'm surrounded by people that want the best for me. I'm sober, and tonight, when I go to bed, I'm going to go right to sleep. Now, what else do I need? Nothing. Nothing at all. And I have no way to thank you. I've tried over the years by trying to give back, and the more I give, the more I get, and I keep getting further behind. So all I can say is thank you for my life, thank you for my sobriety, and thank you for the experience of a power greater than yourself. And again, if you're new and you don't know about this experience, come back. Believe that I believe it. And I promise you, if you do the things that we did, you will get what we got. God bless you.